From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone.
So you did two profiles in City Paper this week, one of Colbert King and the other?
Julie Lawson, who's the Clean City person. They, you know, they asked me to do two this year because I did one last year for you, and they said that was so good I should do two this year.
Well, they actually decided to make you work for a living this year. That's what happened. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Suhas Subramanian, who is a member-elect of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 87th District. Joining us in studio now is Walter Smith. He is the executive director of D.C. Appleseed. Walter Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Walter is here to talk about the fact that the voting rights issue in the district will soon be going to a courtroom near you. Tom Sherwood, let's start talking about all things Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans. Several developments during the course of this week: council proceedings, residents' opinions, and the news, however, has to do with the recall effort.
Yes, just this week, the effort to recall Jack Evans submitted its petition signatures to the Board of Elections. And this is breaking news. Just within a few moments before the show started, we got the first public reaction from Jack Evans' side of the equation. Lawyer Don Dinan told the Kojo Show in a message just a few moments ago that they are still in the midst of reviewing the petition submitted for the recall, but they believe 20 to possibly 30% of them are either fraudulent, the word they used, or illegible, in which case they would not be counted. They say they will file an official response to the recall petition effort Tuesday or Wednesday at the latest, and they will say, ask the Board of Elections to throw out the recall effort, which would force an election, special election, to remove Jack Evans in February if it goes forward. Now, I have talked to Adam Eidinger, who is leading this recall effort. He has said that there may be an effort to throw out the petitions, that if they are thrown out for any reason, he will seek to legally challenge it because he thinks the Ward 2 voting rolls are inflated and they've had to collect far more signatures, 10% of registered voters, than they legally would be required to do otherwise.
And the Evans lawyers are saying that even if the petition is upheld, that it would only precede the primary election by like 10 weeks?
We possibly will face something up to four elections in the next year. If this recall goes forward, there will be a balloting in Ward 2 on whether or not to recall Jack Evans. If that passes, then there will be an election to replace Jack Evans. And then whoever that happens there will be a regular primary for the 2020 election for Ward 2 in June, and then there would be a November general election. Evans people say, look, if you want to throw me out, let the voters of Ward 2 decide by just going to the primary and vote. But, of course, the recall people say his egregious behavior ethically is such that he should be removed from office.
Walter Smith, feel free to chime in at any point during the course of this discussion. As I said, there were several developments this week's council proceedings, D.C. council proceedings, and the Jack Evans investigation. Care to talk about that?
Well, you know, the Post survey, there was a Washington Post survey that said 7 in 10 people thought Jack Evans should resign. And his favorable, Jack Evans's favorability was only 4%, a drop of 29%. But I think one of the strongest, most interesting numbers out of the survey was 67% of the people asked about Jack Evans. 67% said they didn't have enough information to make a comment one way or the other. So that was pretty surprising. 64% thought he should resign. 70%, I think, said he'd done something wrong. But that's an extraordinary number. Didn't have enough knowledge to have an opinion.
And the council this week heard from the attorneys who completed the investigation
Yes.
into Jack Evans. So we'll
and,
have... go ahead.
We should just point out the O'Melveny law firm that had been hired to look into Jack Evans and found at least 11 instances of ethical violations made their presentation. The problem some people think about that and is that Jack Evans is not being invited back to the D.C. Council himself until December 3rd to give his response to that lawyer's report. Most of the lawyers I've talked to, whether they like Jack Evans or not, think that's a very long distance between the two, where one side gets to tell their story, and then 2 weeks later, you get to come in and defend yourself. That seems like a long break. But Mary Che, the chair of the committee, says, well, we got holidays and all kinds of other things, and Evans has to respond. So it's a mess, but it's ongoing.
That's how due process is working in this situation. Before we get to Walter Smith, and Walter, I promise we will get to you, let's talk a little bit about the fact that Mark Elrich, the county executive in Montgomery County, is not adopting or accepting the housing targets set by COG, the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, and the Urban Institute. He says because they imply that the growth of low-wage jobs in Montgomery County requires a certain amount of housing. He does not see that kind of growth of low-wage jobs in Montgomery County. What's going on here?
Well, housing is one of the most desperate needs in the entire region. We hear talk about it a lot on this show. The question is where and how, where are you going to put housing and what kind of housing are you going to get built for people who are in need, both low-income people and middle-income people? The Council of Governments did a report that suggested with, I think, the Urban Institute, suggested that Montgomery County, one of the largest jurisdictions, needs about 23,000 more units of housing, most of them affordable or low income. Mark Elrich, who is considered a progressive, has questioned those numbers. He points to Fairfax County, which is equally in the size and is growing faster than Montgomery, saying they're not being asked to provide this many low-income homes. So he's questioning the procedure. He says we need to have better jobs, and those better jobs will help people get better housing. But so he has objected to this. It's much more complicated than that, but I think that's a summary.
I think we're going to have Mark Elrich in at some point to explore
this issue. I'm sure he would be very happy to come in and talk about this.
Walter Smith, D.C. Appleseed and pro bono attorneys will argue in federal court next Tuesday for full voting congressional representation in the House and Senate for the District of Columbia. D.C. Appleseed filed this complaint in November 2018, and the arguments will be heard almost a year later. Tell us about this lawsuit.
Well, this is a lawsuit that's been pending, as you say, for about a year. It's been fully briefed by our lawyers. A number of friend of the court briefs have been filed. The House of Representatives has come into the lawsuit on the side of District of Columbia residents. The Department of Justice is opposing it on behalf of the Senate and the President.
Who are you suing? How does, just for people who are not lawyers, Lord help us all, you filed the lawsuit where?
We filed the lawsuit in U.S. Federal District Court.
Alleging that the district citizens are unfairly denied voting rights in the House and the Senate?
Right. Unconstitutionally denied.
Unconstitutionally, okay.
And what you do is, in a lawsuit like this, you sue the United States itself. You also sue all of the officials who are responsible for not acting to give us the vote. So we have sued the President. We have sued officials in the House and the Senate. We've also sued the Secretary of Commerce. And the reason for that is that the Census Bureau is within his department, and it's the Census Bureau that apportions House seats throughout the country. And we say it's unconstitutional that he didn't give a seat to the District of Columbia.
In 2000, a similar case made its way to the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. The court ruled in a 2-1 decision that the Constitution granted voting rights in Congress only to states, so that D.C. was ineligible, according to the judges. What makes this time different?
Well, you're right. That lawsuit said that under the Constitution, voting rights was guaranteed only to residents of states. So the court invited us to go to Congress to fix it. So we went to Congress, and both houses agreed that the Congress has authority to grant us the vote, even though we're not residents of a state. But they ended up not granting it to us because they said unless D.C. agreed to the repeal of all of our gun safety laws as part of the deal, that they wouldn't pass the bill. So that bill was withdrawn. That leads us to where we are now. This lets us say in this current lawsuit that since the right to vote is fundamental under the Constitution, and Congress has agreed it can grant us that right, even though we're not residents of states, its failure to do so violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, particularly since no good reason has been shown for continuing to deny us that right.
So you're going into court for what, on the 26th? What is that, next Tuesday or Wednesday?
Next Tuesday morning.
Okay. What will, are these oral arguments?
Oral arguments.
You filed all the paperwork, and Is it a three-court, three-judge panel?
Three-judge panel. There is one judge from the Federal Court of Appeals, Judge Wilkins, and two district court judges, Judge Moss, and Judge McFadden.
Don't get the judge's name wrong.
No.
So you'll have an hour, will be like 30 minutes aside. A lot of people don't get inside the courtroom. These are very formal, structured things. You'll get, 30 minutes?
The court has given our pro bono lawyer from Wilkins, from Harris, the Harris firm, 30 minutes. The House of Representatives lawyer will get 10 minutes. And then the lawyer for the Department of Justice will get 40, since we got 30 plus 10. But since this is the only argument on the docket, it's possible that more time will be granted. It's an important case. I think the three judges know it's a very important case, and they may want to hear more than just 30 minutes to the side.
Who's paying for this lawsuit?
Well, we've brought this lawsuit with the support of a number of pro bono lawyers. So, the filing of the suit and the cost of all of the briefs, I guess, have been borne by our pro bono lawyers Harris, Wiltshire, and Grannis.
Very quickly, the Constitution of the United States gives the District of Columbia, gives the Congress, quote, full legislative authority over the district.
It does.
Unless it can be shown to show that there is racial discrimination or other, why not just say the Constitution says Congress can decide it can't be a state, it won't be a state, and we don't care who lives here, you're not going to be a state.
But there's a distinction between this and statehood, is there not?
There is.
Well, right, in terms of state, but if they have full legislative authority, they don't have to give you members of the House or the Senate either. That's what I meant.
Well, but our argument is that once we show that we're being discriminated against with regard to a fundamental right under the Constitution, that is the right to vote, then the government has to come forward with some rationale for that. In fact, under equal protection analysis, they have to show some compelling governmental reason why they haven't given us the vote. And there really isn't one. And if you read the briefs, you find they haven't identified one.
But there are people who don't think this is the way to go. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have a caller on the line who shares that view. And we have one of the plaintiffs in this case on the line. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour with resident analyst Tom Sherwood. Walter Smith, the executive director of D.C. Appleseed, joins us in studio. We're discussing a lawsuit that has been filed that will be heard next week over the issue of D.C. voting rights. And as I said, we have one of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit on the line. So first, let's hear from Laurie Davis. Laurie Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Why did you decide to be a plaintiff in this case? Why is getting congressional voting representation important to you?
I grew up in a state, Michigan, where I was able to vote for many years. And I moved to D.C. in 1976 and has found it one of the most frustrating aspects of living in the District of Columbia that I have no congressional representation. If I want to complain about an issue or ask a senator to vote the way I might feel about something like gun legislation background checks, I don't have a senator I can go to. I was the general counsel for the D.C. Department of Mental Health in the early 2000s and saw firsthand how difficult it is for the district to enact legislation. We were trying to modify laws related to civil commitment, and the council passed them, and we had consensus among various stakeholders, but then we had to wait and see if Congress would allow this to be enacted or not. And there was nobody I could go to say, you really need to do this. This is an important law. And I think as long as we're in the precarious position of having home rule, we should at the very least have representation in Congress who we can talk to, complain to, support, urge them to vote certain ways on issues. And when I heard that people who live outside the United States have congressional representation and can vote for senators and Congress representatives, but I can't, even though I live physically in the United States, that really made me want to join this.
Well, clearly both you and D.C. Appleseed support going this route through the courts instead of going through the Congress. I think Douglas in Tacoma Park, Maryland, has a slightly different view. Douglas, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I don't think this is going to get anywhere. I think they can stall and stall and stall. For decades, I have not understood why the people of the district haven't been in the streets by the hundreds of thousands, in the halls of Congress, demanding congressional voting representation in the House and Senate. The Founding Fathers were wrong about a lot of things, and this is an obvious one, just like slavery and the vote for...
I'm glad you raised that issue, Douglas, because Anise Jenkins, the executive director of Stand Up for Democracy, a pro-statehood organization, raised the same issue in an article that was in which she was quoted in the Philadelphia Tribune. She said this should be a public debate, not in a courtroom, that there should be people in the streets and in the suites of Congress fighting this. How would you respond to that, Walter Smith?
I think there's more than one way to go about this. I think it's good to be fighting on all fronts at one time. I think people should be trying to support the statehood bill that is pending. I think people marching in the streets is worthwhile, but I also think people going into the courtroom is worthwhile. I think we have a possibility of a 1-2-3 punch here. Let's bring visibility to the lack of democracy. Let's fight for it with every tool we have. And I believe, and this is a lawyer speaking now, we have a really good chance of at long last getting the vote in Congress through this lawsuit, and we should take advantage of that.
A lot of people across the nation don't even understand what the district is, that we have a city, of a district of people here unconnected to the federal government. Right. But does the fact that the Congress changed the Constitution, there was a 1963, was when we got the right to have a vote for right. president. We got three electoral votes in the 1964 election. We've voted in as presidential elections ever since. Does that have any bearing on the fact that we don't have the right to vote for members of the House and Senate?
Well, it's related in that if you're going to have full democracy, you should be able to vote for both president and members of Congress. But the good news about where we are in this lawsuit is that we've got a real good argument that we don't have to go through a constitutional amendment, which is what was done to give us the vote for president. After we lost the first lawsuit that Kodjoe mentioned, we went to Congress and said, you can do this just by passing a law. And both houses agreed with us. And that is what we're basing a lot of the current lawsuit on.
Do you want the Congress, do you want the courts to essentially order the Congress to do this?
No, no.
What
we are asking the court to issue what lawyers call a declaratory judgment. That will be an opinion from the court that says it is unconstitutional that people who live in the District of Columbia do not have voting representation. And it is expected, and there's case law showing what I'm about to say, it is expected that once a declaratory judgment is issued, Congress will respond accordingly.
D.C. Appleseed's press release about this case on Tuesday also mentioned that a number of quote-unquote impressive friend of the court briefs have been filed on your side. Who are these coming from, besides the fact that the U.S. House is going to be on your side? Who are these coming from, and what will these briefs add?
The friend of the court brief usually comes from experts or other interested people who can bring additional information to the court's attention. Two of the most important friend of the court briefs that have been filed is one from a group of distinguished constitutional law professors who are supporting our view that it's unconstitutional, that Congress has not yet given us the vote. And picking up on a point that your caller made, we also have a friend of court brief from a group of distinguished historians who are explaining to the court how it is we got to where we are right now, and explaining to the court that the framers of our Constitution did not intend that we not have the vote. It's just that it's been a long time coming. I just can't help but mention something you said last night, Kojo, from Mark Plotkin. For way too long, we have been spectators of democracy. It is time that we were participants in the democracy.
That was a direct quote from an opinion piece that Mark Plotkin wrote in the Washington Post in July of 2012.
You're referring to the 21st, I think, gala for the D.C. Vote Organization.
I am.
I think it honored Jerry Connolly from Northern Virginia.
Jamie Raskin
from Maryland, who support statehood for the District of Columbia, right, even though economically their states would take a hit in terms of taxing people who work in the district but don't and live in those two
and
states.
And that's changed significantly, because in the past there were people who represented suburban districts,
yes,
in Congress who were opposed to statehood for that very reason. That barrier no longer exists.
Right. And most members of the legislatures in those Congress in those two states support statehood for the district. Some people cynically think, well, they do because they think it's never going to happen.
Right. Well, that's possible.
Sarah emails, D.C. should call the mayor an executive governor, not mayor. No mayor has the state responsibilities that our mayor does. And then here is Sharon in Upper Marlboro. Sharon, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. There's a paper in the Library of Congress called Democracy Denied, the Historical Relationship Between Congress and the District of Columbia, which I'm in the process of rewriting right now. But the bottom line is your guess there is correct. People don't really understand how this happened. The Congress never meant for the people in the district not to have voting rights. But in the crossover after George Washington, these are the two things in the Constitution, the final situation with the District of Columbia and the census, that were not resolved. And that's why we get to dick around with it all the time. It is ridiculous. And over the years, even though it claims it had the right to have the district the way it is, Congress numerous times codified rights it claimed it already had. So that's the most ridiculous thing. And okay, until the people in this district and in the country understand how this happened, nothing's going to change.
Thank you very much for your call, Sharon.
I think that's the point, and I'll ask Walter. Walter, the absence of knowledge about our district, our city, is just overwhelming.
It is.
People just don't even know what it is, where it is, who lives here, why.
It is.
And they just—it's not on their front burner. Some people have called it the civil rights issue of the decade or the decades. But what I don't get with D.C. Vote 21 years, there's still not a sustained, well-funded effort to educate the country about who lives here. Everyone thinks we're just part of the federal government. I'll tell you again, I once was interviewing someone on the mall for my TV show when I was doing it, and I said, what do you think about statehood for the district? And this guy from the South, he said, well, but you work for us, don't you? And he thought that we, including the media people, work for the federal government.
Right.
I can understand that now these days with what's going on, but it's how do you get the public behind this?
Well, I think,
or are you just going to get the courts to do it?
Well, let me say why I think going to the courts is such a good idea. I think you are right that the country doesn't know about our lack of democracy, but the court is going to understand it very, very well based on the briefs that have been submitted by us, by the law professors, by the historians, And I think they are going to understand, and I believe they will agree with us, that since Congress has the authority at long last to give us the vote, there's no good reason for them not to do so, and their failure to do so is unconstitutional.
Where can people go to get the information? Is there a website of DC Appleseed or what?
DCAppleseed.org. And can I make a plug for what's going to happen next Tuesday morning, Kojo?
Yes.
There is going to be a breakfast and pep rally between 8 and 9 a.m. At 441 4th Street. Congresswoman Norton is going to speak. Chairman Mendelson is going to speak. Carl Racine is going to speak. A couple of the plaintiffs are going to speak. And busboys and poets are going to provide breakfast. And we're all going to walk down the hill together to go to the courtroom.
I was going to ask you a question about that, so okay. I'm glad you answered it. Are you expecting the same kind of turnout that we saw during the hearing for Bill H.R. 51?
Well, I hope so.
Hundreds of people showed up.
I hope so, because I believe that the people who came to the statehood hearing have the same stake in what's going to happen in the courtroom as they did is at the hearing, and the result can bring them the same democracy they're seeking.
Don't be late.
Do you know what the court's timeline will be to make a decision?
We don't. The last time we were before the court on this, it took 10 or 11 months. It could take that long again, especially if the three judges are in disagreement.
Is it very possible that if the court ruled in your favor that the district could have congressional elections and Senate elections as early as next year, or is that too fast?
That may be fast, but it's not inconceivable. It depends on how fast the court rules.
What happens if you win this decision? What happens if you lose?
Well, if we win the decision, my guess is that there will be a move to try to appeal that to the Supreme Court, and it goes directly to the Supreme Court. If we lose, I think that our side will be appealing directly to the Supreme Court. So there's a likelihood of it going to the Supreme Court either way, although, depending on how the elections go next year, there may be differing views within the federal government as to whether or not to appeal.
Here is Warren in Washington, D.C. Warren, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Thank you, Kojo, and thank you, Tom, and appreciation for your great broadcasting over the years from both of you.
Thank you.
My question is actually to Kojo. We are hearing today about a very complex issue, an important issue. If it were simple, it would have been decided a long time ago, but it's not simple. So my question is, why are we hearing today only from advocates for the voting rights?
In terms of the individual who is our guest, the news of this story is that a lawsuit has been filed by D.C. Appleseed. That's why Walter Smith, representing D.C. Appleseed, is a guest on this program.
Yeah, and he's telling us about how he's going into court for the court hearing on Tuesday, and we've discussed all the opposition to it, I believe, the people who have filed complaints to friends of court briefs one way or the other. Is that correct, Walter?
Well, there were no friend of court brief filed against us. Nobody filed any argument against us other than the Department of Justice. And I should also add that what we are trying to achieve here is overwhelmingly supported by residents of the District of Columbia.
But maybe not Warren. Warren, what is your position on this issue?
I happen to believe, as former resident of a state, that it's not obvious that the district should be treated as a state. It's not treated as a state under the U.S. Code. By definition, it's treated for very specific purposes when Congress says it shall be treated. So, to me, it's not obvious that it should be granted voting rights. And that's why I think it's important that even though the latest Appleseed action is of newsworthy note, that I think there should be.
Warren, may I? This is Tom. Excuse me. Thank you. Warren, where do you live?
On Capitol Hill.
And so you're okay with not voting for a member of Congress or in the Senate? Or you would like it, or you just don't think it's required?
Well, when I moved here, part of my decision was that I knew that I was giving up certain votes. And the idea is that it's a choice that I made, and people who were born here could, if they felt that they wanted to vote for Congress, that they could move somewhere else. So to me, it's something that people are aware of, and if it is something that disturbs people, there are actions they can take.
And I think one of those actions is the action that D.C. Appleby's seat is taking about it. So we're going to continue to have this conversation, but we do have to take a short break and introduce our next guest. So Walter Smith, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
Walter Smith is the executive director of D.C. Appleseed. Up next, Suhas Subramanian, who is a member-elect to the Virginia House of Delegates. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Joining us in studio now is Suhas Subramanian, who is a member-elect of the Virginia House of Delegates, 87th District, representing Loudoun and Prince William counties. He is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your election.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. My wife's a big fan of the show, so I'm glad to be on.
It's my understanding that you were the first Indian American elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. You were also in a historic primary where I think every Democratic candidate was a first-generation American. What do you think your win in the first-of-its-kind primary say about Virginia, both where it used to be and where it's heading?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I first started running, people actually saw my name. They said I should probably change it if I want to run for office. It's a funny name. It's a long name. But I kind of take pride in the fact that I won, even with a name like mine. And I never thought of myself as the Indian American candidate. I thought of myself as someone who had a background that worked in the Obama White House and on Capitol Hill. And so I had a background in this. And, I loved doing it. And I was passionate about the community and who happened to be Indian American. And so when I started running, I started realizing that, you know, people were saying that history could be made. And, I've embraced it. I love it. I love the fact that there are a lot of people of all backgrounds who they have kids now who are getting more and more interested in politics because of the run. And so I'm proud of it. But I'm also, want to make sure we get things done.
Is this your first run for elective office?
It is my first run.
Even
yes.
In college, your student president or anything like that, any kind of electoral victory in the past or defeat?
Oh, actually, I ran for treasurer of my high school, and I got second. I lost. I used paper towels and put them on the back of people's backs that said "Vote for Suhas." So we had a little more money this time to run a campaign. But
just very briefly in 20 seconds, you're a lawyer. You tell me, corporate style lawyer, or you help corporations. What do you? You're a corporate lawyer, is that right?
Yeah, I'm an attorney. I help startups get off the ground. And
you mentioned your high school. Where did you grow up?
That was in Houston, Texas.
But he also functioned as an attorney in a Capitol Hill office at one point, and also in the Obama administration.
Yeah, I've worked in every branch of government at almost every level, and so I've been around the block.
And Tom Sherwood always likes to say, what should people know about you? One of the things I found out is that you're a volunteer firefighter EMT with the Ashburn Volunteer Fire Department. How did that come about? What caused you to be interested in doing that?
I got a flyer in the mail. I had a friend who was doing it, and I decided it might be a great way to help the community.
No family background in firefighting or EMT?
No family background in it.
And are you on call? How does that work?
You go in once a week, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., and whenever you get a call, you go out. And so whatever comes up.
We did a show about volunteer firefighters on this broadcast just a couple of weeks ago. You can find it in our archives. We talked with people from Maryland and the District of Columbia, but at least now we've got Virginia in the house.
That's right.
So you won the seat in Prince William and Loudoun counties that John Bell had held for several terms. I can't remember how many. This is your first elective office. And you've been down to Richmond a few times for organizational purposes and all that. What did Bell tell you what to expect? Because the aspirational aspects of running for office and then getting things done are two different games.
Yeah, Bell is I've had a lot of great mentors, and Bell was definitely one of them. And, I think he's a statesman, and he wants to make sure you get things done for the community and put the community first. And so, that was why I was running, and that was what I was after. And so, he said, focus on getting things done for the community and everything will work out.
Okay, so the governor of the state, Ralph Northam, has just this week said he wants to do free community college. Yes or no?
Yes, I support getting there, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was about to say, our community colleges play a really vital role. We have Northern Virginia Community College in my district, and that's a great way for people to get training and experience and get the education they need, especially given the cost of college right now.
Are you a progressive person? There's lots of, you know, across the country and in local jurisdictions here in Maryland, Virginia, progressives. You want to raise the minimum wage? Do you? What about the right to work law in Virginia?
You know, I always
I'm
thought
just trying to put you on the spot very quickly.
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely. You know, it's hard to label me, but I always thought I was a moderate. But I, every time I, you know, start talking about my stance on the issues, it seems I'm progressive. It looks like so. In this environment, so you know, I think raising the minimum wage is really having a livable wage for people is incredibly important.
Well, let's test you on some issues. As we said, you're
yeah,
a lawyer,
you tell me.
Former Capitol Hill and Obama administration policy analyst. I know the General Assembly is considering a state constitutional amendment for an independent redistricting committee. Where do you stand on this approach to redistricting?
Yeah, so I want redistricting to be fair and nonpartisan. Now, you know, the defining those terms is kind of difficult these days. The constitutional amendment is not perfect. It has a lot of flaws. You know, one of them is that delegates would serve on this commission that would create the new districts. Another one is that if they can't come to a conclusion, it would be kicked over to a pretty partisan court system right now. And so I think it has some flaws. If it's the best option and the fairest option on the table, I would definitely support it.
It passed the General Assembly this past year.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to pass the Assembly again coming up in January.
That's right.
In the new session.
That's
and
right.
Then it goes to the voters. If you make any changes, does that reset the clock and would have to go through two more
so.
Cycles?
I believe okay. So. And so you can pass a normal bill to get something done for 2021 and then try to do a constitutional amendment for the next time redistricting okay. happens.
Well, that's Virginia has virtually no campaign finance laws. This worked in the Democrats' favor for this election. Democratic candidates generally outspent their Republican opponents, receiving big dollar donations. And according to the Virginia Public Access Project, you spent over $300,000 on your campaign, while your Republican opponent, Bill Drennan, spent just over $15,000. What do you think of Virginia's campaign finance laws?
Oh, it absolutely needs to be reformed. There's no cap
despite on the fact that it benefited you?
I think that, we need to have the reform. We also, you know, in order to make the reform, you have to win your election, right? You're not going to make any reform if you're on the sidelines. And so I do think, though, we need, comprehensive campaign finance reform. We need to have a cap on how much individuals can contribute. We need to have some sort of regulation on how much corporations. I support public financing of elections. I think that we need to get the money completely out of politics or as much as possible. But until then, I'm all for any sort of baby steps that gets us to a system where the money is less influential in our political races.
We raced ahead. I meant to ask you at the very start. You had not run for office before, and why? What prompted you? Were you drafted? Did Mr. Bell and other people come to you and say you should run? Were you sitting at home with your family and you said, I can do this job? Was there some moment that where you decided you would be the public servant?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the short answer is what an opportunity. I felt like, you know, Democrats had a chance to be in the majority for the first time in a long time and to be a part of that.
And Bell was running for the Senate, right?
Yeah. Originally, actually, I was running for the Senate seat, and then Bell decided to run for it, and I decided I wanted to keep his seat blue. And I decided to run because I think we had an incredible opportunity. We do now in front of us to make some great changes in the state of Virginia. I went and lobbied. The first time I went to Richmond actually was to lobby for equality. There's a group called Equality Virginia,
mm-hmm.
And to lobby for LGBTQ equality. And when we got down there, it was 51-49, but there was zero progress on the issue. Unfortunately, you can still discriminate against people, housing and employment, and I think that's wrong. And the fact that we're one seat short of making that big leap that we need to make in Virginia. That was definitely a moment that really opened my eyes.
We got to mention guns.
Before we mention guns, since we're talking about equality, Virginia could become the final state needed to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment to amend the U.S. Constitution. Would you support the ERA once it's brought to a floor vote?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm surprised that didn't happen last session, but I'm glad we're going to have the opportunity. I'm thankful to have the opportunity to be able to vote for it this time.
Lots of gun issues are going to be presented to the legislature. I won't go through the whole history because it would take too long. But just this week in Louisa County, which is a county between Richmond and Charlottesville, for those who don't know, there's a group that's trying to set up a gun rights sanctuary so that even if there are restrictions on guns that the legislature passes or anything else happens, they want to be sure that anyone who comes to Louisa County will have unfettered rights to the Second Amendment. Where are you on guns? This is, as you know, all the polls show people want something done on guns. The question is, what would be done? What do you support?
Yeah, I think the important thing people need to realize is we're not trying to go into their homes and take their guns. We're just trying to get common sense.
That was Beto O'Rourke's position.
Yeah, that's not, I mean, that's not what's being proposed, though. What's being proposed is we want to make sure that there's common sense gun reforms, that's responsible gun ownership.
And registration?
So, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then
limit on the number you can purchase. Governor Wilder had got passed a one gun a month bill. Would you want to see that return?
Anything that works, because, you know, Rockridge.
Do you
High
own
School,
a gun?
I do not own a gun, no. But I think we have to have tremendous respect for these weapons. And, you know, Rockridge High School is in my district, and we've had a couple of gun scares already, a couple of violent scares. And people don't want to feel like they're taking a risk by sending their kid to school or going into a public place. And so anything that works, we've seen other states enact some laws. And if someone tells me that a proposal is what works, if someone tells me that mental health is the answer, I don't think it is. But if someone showed me proof of that.
Assistance.
Perhaps. But I just want to see what works. And, you know, universal background checks, red flag laws, those seem to be working. And so I want to do what works.
Boyd from Alexandria emailed, I would like to know what we can do about climate change in the state legislature.
Absolutely. We need to make sure that we are encouraging the development of renewable energy. Virginia can be the renewable energy capital of America, of the world.
Well, Virginia's going to have one of the largest offshore wind farms in the world. I mean, certainly in the country. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, and the governor put forth some ambitious goals, and I think we can be even more ambitious. And so now with the Democratic majority, we can start to make some meaningful reforms and tackle this issue.
Is there a danger that the Democrats could overreach? You've got the Republicans on the run for the last several elections. On the national scale, there are several progressive candidates running for president on the Democratic side. Even President Obama has waved a caution flag.
There's no such thing as overreaching if what you're doing is for the people of the state. I don't believe if people of the state want to have serious climate change reforms, want to seriously address the issue of gun violence, and you deliver that to them, that's not overreaching. That's doing what the people who voted for you told you to do.
Virginia Democrats chose Delegate Eileen Filicorn to be the next Speaker of the House. She appointed the chairs of the Appropriations Committee, the Finance Committee, the Commerce and Labor Committee, and the Education Committee last week, all four of them veteran legislators. What committees are you hoping to be assigned to?
Yeah, so education is an incredibly important issue to me. And people moved to Loudoun County because of the great schools, Prince William County because of the great schools. And I want to make sure that they stay great and that they have the resources they need, that our teachers get paid what they're worth. The Science and Technology Committee is right now a committee that you get sent to if you don't want, if you were mean to the speaker before, or if you weren't going to get any bills. And so, being in that committee and reforming it would actually be a great thing to do, because science and technology is so important in Northern Virginia. It's part of our identity. And so having a science and tech committee that's a punishment right now is a shame. So I think as part of Democrats being in power, I would love to see that change.
Explain your role in the White House as it related to technology.
Yeah. But just briefly, when will you know what your committee assignments are so the lobbyists can start lining up? When would that be done? Not till January?
Beginning of January, yeah. I believe so.
And your function in the Obama White House?
Yeah, I was a technology advisor to President Obama. We had a what was called a technology policy task force. And so we were charged with trying to address some of the biggest challenges in the technology world, which is basically the biggest challenges in the world. So
did he endorse you? Did he endorse a variety of people in the state? I don't remember seeing your name on there.
He didn't need to endorse me. I had it in the bag, so we were good. We had other people we needed to help.
You have a background in healthcare policy. You served on Capitol Hill as a healthcare and veterans policy aide. I also mentioned that you were a volunteer firefighter an EMT. More recently, you were on the Loudoun Health Council, appointed by the County Board of Supervisors. What are your goals around the issue of health care?
And how old are you to have done all those things?
I'm 33.
Okay.
Yeah, health care, you know, we're talking a lot about coverage, and I'm so glad we got Medicaid expanded in the state. It'd be great to get rid of those work requirements. But more importantly, I know a lot of families who, you know, their incomes are high, but health care is such a burden. The cost of health care is so high right now. I've seen people pay $1,300 for children's Tylenol at the hospital. There's the cost of healthcare. Something is going on, and especially something that I'm going to be focusing on this session is the cost of prescription drugs.
$1,300 for children's Tylenol at the
hospital? It's not called Tylenol. It's called whatever else.
Right.
I ask you, healthcare was across the board a big issue for Democrats in the state. Let me ask you, though, because do you live in Prince William or Loudoun?
I live in Loudoun in Ashburn.
Mm-hmm. And so you have to drive to Richmond. I assume there's no...
Here comes the transportation.
Yes, the transportation. You know, we've had many people running for office in Virginia. They all say traffic is a nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
You've driven 95. You know it's a nightmare. Around Fredericksburg, people want to expand 95, more lanes, induced demand, maybe more cars. Mm-hmm. Where are you on transportation issues? Is there anything particular on your agenda?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a small fortune trying to get to D.C. this morning. We have a very expensive toll road that's been there for a long time, and I just want to control the costs of tolls in the state. We have Route 50 in my district that's, you know, we just expanded a lane, but expanding a lane just meant more cars on the road.
Yeah, induced demand.
And so I think we need to be smarter about we need to approach the issue of traffic comprehensively. It's not just about how wide the lanes are. It's about how you're developing, whether you're putting the infrastructure in first, you know, whether we have smart traffic management. There's a lot of things we can do.
In transit.
Mm-hmm, exactly, exactly.
We only have about a minute and a half left. The Republican candidate who opposed you, Bill Drennan, was anti-abortion. Where do you fall on abortion in particular and reproductive health care in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to protect a woman's right to choose. And I think that, you know, Virginia, you know, there's been a lot of bills over the past couple sessions that, you know, don't reflect what Virginians want, which is to protect that right.
Suhas Subramanian is a member-elect of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 87th District, Loudoun and Prince William counties. He's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having
me. When's the swear-in date?
It's on January 11th. Everyone's invited. It's at 5 p.m. at the Capitol building. So come down to Richmond and join us.
Tom Sherwood, we only have about a minute left. Talk about the poll about D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser.
New Post, Washington Post poll shows that the mayor is maintaining her popularity in the city. Is that the city's running well, that they like what she's mainly doing. There are issues here and there. But overall, if you're a politician like the mayor, you're glad to see this poll.
On the other hand, former Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh is not doing that well. She just pleaded guilty to 4 counts of conspiracy and tax evasion, and it's entirely possible that she could be facing jail time.
She faces up to 5 years in prison for the. She pled guilty to 4 counts of fraud and with her book Healthy Holly. She had been charged with 11 counts, but she pled guilty. Who knows what she'll get? But this is a terrible ending for someone who people thought would do well for Baltimore as the mayor, but let personal greed or need get in the way of her public service. And there was another post poll. Most of the people in the Washington believe the Redskins should play at RFK, but that shouldn't be paid for by city tax dollars.
And that it should be paid for by the owner of the team.
Yes.
That's it for today. Today's show was produced by Sydney Grannon. There's also a Kristen Grannon in the control room today. That would be Sydney's mom. Welcome. Hopefully she didn't notice how much fun we're having and thinks that Sydney has a real job. Coming up on Monday, join Tom and me for a conversation with Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. He no longer lives under a national spotlight, so what are his priorities these days? And we may have a musical surprise or two for you as well. That all starts at noon on Monday. Last week you promised to do absolutely nothing. Tom Sherwood, did you?
I managed to do 3, almost 4 days of nothing. It was wonderful. I recommend it.
So this weekend you should be fairly active. As you said, we'll see you again on Monday. Until then, you have a wonderful weekend. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Margaret Barthel, Lauren Marco, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Mona Kashvi. Our engineer is Natalie Yurovlivker. Our intern is Laura Spitalniak. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kodjo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.